From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, day one of the Syrian peace conference in Switzerland, and the US comes under fire after insisting that Bashar al-Assad must be removed from power.
There is no way possible that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern.
Also today, the violence in Ukraine turns deadly. The talk at the White House turns to electoral reform and how to protect the franchise. And in Virginia, a former governor vows to battle corruption charges.
I will use every available resource to fight and prevail.
Plus, the high-tech group connecting San Francisco's homeless with employment. It's all ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main stories.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts. Syria's government and opposition have angrily spelled out their mutual hostility at UN peace talks in Switzerland. The conference, aimed at bringing an end to the conflict in Syria, is the first time the two sides have met. The co-sponsors of the conference, the USA and Russia, also revealed their differences. US Secretary of State John Kerry indicated the main aim was to remove President Assad from power, but this was rejected by the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Laura Rosen is covering the talks for the news website Al Monitor. She says although it's not the most positive of starts, it could have been worse.
I think expectations were so low. Even two days ago, it wasn't entirely obvious that everyone was going to show up. So the fact that they all showed up, that they kind of got in a room and started this process, it's probably at least meets expectations.
The conflict in Syria has claimed some 100,000 lives and left millions without a home. The Syrian government and opposition groups gather for face-to-face meetings in Geneva on Friday. On Sunday, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon asked Iran to attend before withdrawing the invitation amid concerns the talks would collapse. Richard Gowan from New York University's Center for International Cooperation says no one expects the talks to achieve much.
The only question about the Swiss talks is whether they fail completely with a total breakdown, or whether diplomats manage to find a few positive deliverables, perhaps humanitarian ceasefires for cities like Aleppo, which have been under siege. Very frankly, for weeks it's been clear that the best you could hope for was some small successes that could provide the basis for later negotiations. No one expects a real political settlement here.
The US is strongly condemning violence in the Ukraine, which has led to the deaths of three street protesters. The statement includes pointed criticism of President Viktor Yanukovych's government while he's engaging in talks with opposition leaders. From Washington, Daniel Rentschus reports.
The US State Department is urging all sides to immediately de-escalate the situation and refrain from violence. The statement says the increased tensions are a direct consequence of the government's failure to engage in real dialogue and the passage of anti-democratic legislation. But they blamed recent aggressive actions on an extreme right group, Pravi Sektor, and other informal groups, which they say are inflaming conditions on the streets. Peaceful protests began when last November the government of President Viktor Yanukovych threw out a trade deal with the European Union in favour of financial support from Russia. Daniel Rentschus, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. In China, a well-known human rights lawyer, Xu Jiyong, who campaigned against corruption, has gone on trial. The main charge involves him allegedly gathering crowds to disrupt public order. Mr. Xu is one of several activists from a transparency group set for trial this week. Human rights groups have accused President Xi Jinping, who had vowed to fight corruption, of failing to deliver on that promise. A report has also come out saying members of China's elite have been stashing away cash in offshore companies in tax havens abroad. The United Nations has called for an inquiry into the capsizing of a boat carrying migrants while being towed by a Greek Coast Guard vessel. Up to 12 people died in the incident. The Coast Guard says it thought it was safe to keep the migrants on their own boat rather than take them aboard in bad weather. Greek officials say the migrants were panicking and tipped the boat up themselves, but human rights organizations have pointed to the alleged harassment of illegal migrants by the Greek authorities. An Iranian-American engineer accused of attempting to ship stolen documentation about a high-tech military plane to Iran has been indicted. 59-year-old Mozaffer Kazai has been charged with 2 counts of transporting stolen goods by a grand jury in Connecticut. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
Mr. Kazai was arrested earlier this month for trying to smuggle thousands of pages of F-35 Joint Strike Fighter documents. He's believed to have stolen the sensitive materials from defence contracting companies where he was employed. According to court records, customs officials and Homeland Security agents intercepted a shipment Mr. Kazai was sending to Iran in November. It was marked as containing household goods, but instead officials found boxes of technical manuals related to the F-35 programme. Mr. Kazai was arrested earlier this month at Newark Airport on his way to Iran. If convicted, he faces up to 20 years in prison.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Syrian peace talks that many doubted would ever occur got underway in the Swiss town of Montreux today, and within hours of opening, stark differences of opinion were on open display. US Secretary of State John Kerry indicated that from Washington's perspective, the main aim is to remove President Bashar al-Assad from power.
There is no way possible in the imagination that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov rejected that, telling the UN brokered forum that the outcome of the peace conference shouldn't be predetermined by anyone. And Syria's Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualem said he was outraged that the country's rebels and their international supporters had even been given a seat at the table.
Representatives of states in this room are sitting with us today while the Syrian blood is on their hands. Countries that have exported terrorism.
So how to judge an opening day like that? FSN's Kate Fisher spoke to Laura Rosen. She is in Montreux covering the talks for the news website Al Monitor.
Yeah, I mean, Kerry was quite realistic, saying, look, like, you know, peace has not broken out overnight, but it's the first time in 3 years that basically you've had the two sides in the civil war sit down in the same room, and it is a beginning, and this is going to be a process, and it's going to lead to a political transition, at the end of which Assad will not be at the top of the Syrian government. You know, it'll be a representative. So that was interesting, and I think it's fair to say that the two sides do plan to move events to Geneva on Friday. It's not clear if they're going to be in the same room or be in separate rooms and have the UN envoy Brahimi and team going back and forth between them. But there does seem to be now confirmation that both sides plan for it to be a more ongoing process for what comes next. You know, week in, week off. So that seems encouraging to me that you can make more progress over time, given that they're so far apart. You know, over time, if they're going to keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back in a low-profile way to try to work out some humanitarian relief and other things like that.
That does sound very positive. So Kerry is absolutely adamant that Assad will be removed.
He is absolutely adamant. And it was very interesting also because the Syrian regime side, their ambassador, Jafari, gave a press conference just a bit ago after Kerry. And they said they were disappointed with today's proceedings. And it kind of reinforced the sense that the Syrian regime side, who you might feel would come here feeling very confident and cocky because, you know, they've lasted all this time, they do not seem to be as confident as you would expect. They seemed a bit off balance all day. And they expressed, you know, disappointment that Iran didn't come. They said that the 40 foreign ministers who came today were almost all against them, the anti-Syrian, he said. So it was interesting. I think coming into this, you might have thought that they, you know, would be very cocky and could make the opposition look disorganized and not representative. But instead, I think they seemed taken aback.
But having said all of that, there was just so much hostility today. How is this process ever actually going to work when there's just so much bad blood?
Right. And I mean, there is hard to overstate, you know, that, you know, you have the regime side saying that all the opposition is, you know, foreign-backed traitors and terrorists, and then you have the opposition side saying that the, you know, Assad regime are the terrorists, and they basically, you know, even allegations that Assad may have supported these al-Qaeda-backed, some of these al-Qaeda-backed militants operating with the opposition. So, yes, they're very, very far apart. But, I mean, you would see in the hallway the Syrian opposition media guy followed, surrounded by journalists, and then you would see the Syrian regime media guy, you know, from the Assad's president's office with his scrum in the same hallway. And I don't think that's happened before in 3 years. Not that, you know, there's any love between them and no one's getting a coffee in the back room. This is not the kind of more tentative, you know, encouraging things we've seen between the U.S. and Iran in the past 3 months. These people hate each other, but they are coming to this forum, and it seems like they're agreeing to a process, assenting to a process of mediation.
Laura Rosen, and you can follow her reporting from Montreux on the news website Al Monitor. This is FSN Reports. The sound of blood being shed on the streets of the Ukrainian capital Kiev for the first time since protests against the government of President Viktor Yanukovych started last year. Two people died after being shot on the very day that new laws came into force that are aimed at restricting protests. FSN's Anya Ardayeva joins me on the line from our Moscow bureau. Now, Anya, both the Russian and Ukrainian governments have been warning that these protests could escalate and pose a real threat to Ukraine's future, and that was before anybody died. So what's the likely impact of these two fatalities on the protest movement?
There are several different scenarios of how this situation could develop from now on. It could be either that the government orders the police to storm and crush the protesters and dismantle the barricades that have been there for a few weeks after protests in Kyiv began more than 60 days ago. What is unclear at this point is how exactly and who exactly killed those people in Kyiv. They were definitely shot. Some reports suggested that police is to blame, while others say that this could have been a provocation from the ultra-nationalists who are now very active in Kyiv, and reports suggest that a group of hardcore radicals are mostly the ones attacking police with petrol bombs and stones at the moment. So if the investigation proves that those protesters were shot by the police, certainly we will see those protests intensifying. If on the opposite, it will be proved that they were shot by someone else, I think that would scare away many people from taking part in those protests.
Is there anything at this point that President Yanukovych can do, short of calling the snap elections that protesters are demanding, to quell this uprising against him?
He could certainly try to talk to those people who are out on the streets at the moment and try to start some sort of dialogue with them. First part of the dialogue began today when Viktor Yanukovych met with three leaders of the opposition. Now, the talks went on for more than 3 hours. The opposition emerged without saying anything to the media, and they just got into their cars and left. So we don't know what happened during those negotiations, but it looks like maybe the first step towards a dialogue in Ukraine has been made.
FSN's Anya Ardayeva on the line from our Moscow bureau. Here in Washington, just days after commemorating the life and activism of Dr. Martin Luther King, President Obama met with the Commission on Election Administration. He received a long-awaited report on ways to combat voter disenfranchisement in the United States. But groups monitoring voting rights on the ground say the Commission's non-binding recommendations don't go far enough, and they're calling for stronger state and federal protections against practices that have in recent years disproportionately impacted low-income voters and voters of color. From Capitol Hill, FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
The president's bipartisan commission on election administration declared Wednesday that no citizen should have to wait in line more than 30 minutes to vote, and released the results of a six-month study that found expanding early voting by mail and in person and expanding online voter registration would help. During the 2012 presidential election, voters in Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and other key battleground states waited many hours to cast a ballot, while tens of thousands more were estimated to have given up and not voted at all. Attorney Leah Aiden with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund calls this a modern-day form of voter suppression.
We are seeing efforts by states to restrict the number of days of early voting, to institute more and more strict voter ID laws, to change polling places at the last minute, to do many things that confuse voters, make them feel like they should not be participating or that people don't want them to participate, and just setting up barriers for them to participate, which is something that, again, we should be encouraging, not discouraging.
The President's Commission also warned Wednesday of what they call an impending crisis. They said voting machines purchased en masse over a decade ago are wearing out and need replacement, but there are currently no federal funds allocated for that work. The report noted, too, that many polling places across the country are not accessible to people with disabilities, and many communities that speak other languages lack adequate bilingual ballots and poll workers. The Commission's recommendations are non-binding. They can only urge state and local officials to adopt them. What could make a bigger difference is a bill introduced in Congress earlier this month to revive the Voting Rights Act that was struck down by the Supreme Court last year. Bill sponsor and longtime civil rights advocate John Lewis said he's pleased the new version would give voters more opportunities to report discrimination, but expressed concern it would only mandate federal oversight of four states: Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, and his home state of Georgia.
I will admit that it's not a perfect deal, but it is a necessary and good beginning. We had to do what we could to respond to the United States Supreme Court decision made only a few months ago. The swift action we took on this issue demonstrates the importance of the right to vote to members on both sides of the aisle.
The bill's backers in the Senate say they're confident it won't be filibustered. But few Republicans have declared their support, while some have declared outright opposition. Texas Senator John Cornyn told the Dallas Morning News that the bill discriminates against his state, saying he doesn't understand why it treats them as if it's 1965. But the new formula does not treat any state as if it's 1965. It uses the same criteria for all states, as bill sponsor and Wisconsin Republican Jim Sensenbrenner recently explained to reporters.
In crafting the new formula, we started from scratch. States will be covered if a court finds that they committed five voting violations over 15 years. And that includes not only those states that have been under preclearance, but this bill has nationwide application.
The NAACP and other voting rights groups are pushing for the bill to be amended and are particularly taking issue with special provisions that exclude voter ID laws from being counted as violations of voting rights. But Aiden and other legal advocates say it's also important to get something on the books as soon as possible, as the Supreme Court's ruling this past summer striking down part of the old Voting Rights Act left many voters vulnerable. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Although the federal investigation of my family has been indescribably agonizing over this past year, I believe that the facts and the law are clearly on our side.
The former Republican governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, proclaiming his innocence after he and his wife were indicted in a 43-page Justice Department document. It accuses them of using their positions to assist a wealthy businessman, Johnny Williams of the dietary supplement company Star Scientific, who allegedly gave them gifts and cash. Speaking to reporters last night, the former governor said he and his wife Maureen will contest the charges.
I will use every available resource and advocate that I have for as long as it takes to fight and prevail against these false allegations and the unjust overreach of the federal government.
The laying of charges against the McDonald's has caused shockwaves in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Jim Nolan is covering the story for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And Jim, you heard there Governor McDonnell accusing the feds of prosecutorial overreach, but this is a damning indictment that he and his wife face. What's at the heart of their defense?
I think they're going to say that they did nothing wrong, that they extended no special treatment to Mr. Williams or his company, and will point to evidence they have that shows that the company, in fact, received no grants, no board considerations, no research funding, which it was clear that they were seeking and Johnny Williams was seeking. However, that might not be enough to avoid the charge that they attempted to provide assistance to him, as evidenced by a number of areas where Johnny Williams and the company were included or given access to government officials and the opportunity to make the pitch for their dietary supplement to some very high-level state officials. Now, the McDonald's will say that that is not any different than any kind of assistance that they would have given to any other company in the Commonwealth. The difference is that few other Commonwealth companies or CEOs have provided a First Family of Virginia with more than $135,000 in luxury gifts, trips, jewelry, cash, and loans.
I mean, it is the nature of the detail that's contained in this indictment that is, in a way, so surprising, isn't it? I mean, I know you've been following the story for a long while there. People in the rest of the country haven't necessarily been following it, but this indictment goes into more detail than I think anybody ever knew. Is that right?
A lot of what is contained in the indictment had been reported in our newspaper and in the Washington Post, which has also done a tremendous job on the story. But I think what emerges from the excruciating detail of the indictment is a sense that the McDonald's were a couple that, while they were at the top of the Virginia governmental hierarchy, they were nevertheless, on a personal level, strapped financially. They had debts stemming from their ownership of some very high-priced vacation rental properties in the mountains, in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, and at Virginia Beach, that put a lot of financial pressure on them personally and put them into debt, effectively. And here comes Johnny Williams, who has plenty of money and is eager to get his dietary supplement, the research funding, and the acceptance and the legitimization of the endorsement of the state and the governor as the key to its success. He has the money, the McDonald's have the need, and I think what the federal prosecutors are going to try and prove is that that environment led the McDonald's to be corrupted.
I mean, we usually think of big money polluting American politics. In a way, this indictment suggests it was a lack of money that allegedly polluted the politics of the governor's mansion.
I think we have to separate the personal financial condition of the First Family with the nature of politics in general. Virginia is notoriously lax when it comes to its ethics and disclosure rules. You can give a Virginia politician any amount of gifts or cash or considerations. And the only requirement that is incumbent upon the official is that if that gift exceeds $50, that it has to be declared on an annual financial disclosure statement. And what had happened is the McDonald's, in that respect, have received gifts. The volume of the gifts was extremely high. There is evidence that they perhaps failed to disclose the nature of the gifts. And perhaps most critical to the trouble that they're in from the federal indictment is that when it came to declaring their receipt of loans from Mr. Williams, feds are alleging that the McDonald's made false statements on financial documents in the application for additional loans. And that is a very, very serious crime for which people go to jail.
So what evidence are you seeing on the ground now of the reaction to this calculating into calls for a tightening of what you call those notoriously lax regulations?
Public officials are very nervous, and I think there's been as divided as Republicans and Democrats can be in this what we call a swing state. There seems to be a unilateral agreement that something must be done to tighten the ethics laws in Virginia. Certainly this indictment comes right at the very beginning of the annual legislative session of the Virginia General Assembly. So ethics reform is top on the priority list of many who have come here to Richmond to pass laws and pass the budget for the coming year.
Jim Nolan of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Now, San Francisco's Tenderloin is a neighbourhood with a frighteningly high concentration of homeless people, most of whom cannot find employment. And these days, of course, it's difficult to get a job unless you've got an email address or you know your way around a computer. So in order to help the homeless and connect them to employment opportunities, a free tech lab run by a local charity has opened its doors. From FSN's bureau in San Francisco, Rebecca Bowring reports.
About 100 people a day call in to use the PCs and surf the internet at this computer lab in the Tenderloin, a troubled neighborhood of San Francisco. Most of them are homeless. They come here as part of a free program aimed at helping them become more tech savvy. Megan Trotter is program manager at the Tenderloin Technology Lab.
There's, you know, a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of different things happening on the street. It's pretty amazing that we have the space here where, you know, it's quiet, you know, it's a very calm environment, which is very different from the streets just right outside.
That's where about 6,500 people are sleeping rough. The city spends some $200 million every year trying to get them back into society, but many never make it. Finding a permanent place to live depends on having the funds to pay for one, and for that you need a job. Megan Trotter again.
A big thing is that, you know, employment. So in searching for jobs, it's not possible to kind of walk from place to place and drop off your resume. It's more practical to go on a computer, look on Craigslist, look on these different job sites, and send out your resume that way.
You've been doing that with Word. You go down to the start button.
Many of those who come here take IT classes, ranging from the most basic concepts, how to use a mouse, to a lesson on Excel spreadsheets.
And it's got columns and it's got rows.
One person who's benefited is 24-year-old Scott Stanley. He struggled with drug addiction for many years, but has now been clean for 8 months.
I come to this tech lab to work on resumes, job applications, anything that can help me with my dreams and goals. And it helps me focus. It's a great place to come. You know, they got a lot of resources here.
Scott dreams of opening his own tattoo shop. The lab also offers a workshop in micro labor to introduce users to websites like TaskRabbit, where they can find odd jobs to earn money. Ray Benton is a chemist with a master's degree. After losing his job, he slept in his car for 6 months. He used the facilities here to brush up on his computer skills and has since been recruited by a tech company.
They went on LinkedIn and saw my resume, my profile, and saw I was at the tech lab and saw my education and went, oh, we'll see if he wants to work for us.
Although it's only a drop in the ocean where San Francisco's homelessness problem is concerned, this initiative does demonstrate the power of technology to help get people off the streets and back on their feet. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the program by email. The address is reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Tomorrow from Denver, the US war veterans discharged from the army for minor violations and left without medical care.
When you release these people who aren't medically ready to return to society, then that burden becomes the communities.
That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington alongside Nina Maria Potts at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.